Let me begin by saying that this talk is based upon a book in progress with my colleague Jared Day. It is also based in part upon the oral history project at Carnegie Mellon that Carrs is conducting under Ben Houston's directorship. Our work on this book and at the Oral History Project is also a response to some of the transformations in the scholarship on African-American urban history. Those of you who work with African-American history, particularly on blacks in cities, you know that 10 years ago, with the exception of books by Thomas Sugrue and Honor Hirsch, there were very few systematic studies of African-American life since World War II. Moreover, if you look at the early studies, that is, those studies that occurred 10 years ago or earlier, very few of them made use of the rich possibilities of oral history. But I am happy to report, as many of you also know, that over the past decade, late 20th century African-American urban life has gained increasing historical treatment, including the use of oral history. We've got a rich body of scholarship that includes studies on numerous cities, including New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, Oakland, Los Angeles, Baltimore, Greensboro, and New Orleans. And that doesn't nearly exhaust the list. But what we find is that if you look at this body of scholarship in terms of systematic historical research, Pittsburgh is largely absent from this literature. And as a result, it's also pretty much absent from the kind of debates, interesting debates, that this literature has generated. And so what I would like to suggest today is that a focus on Pittsburgh is justified. It is not only justified by what we could call the dearth of scholarship on the city of Pittsburgh, but it's justified by Pittsburgh's place in the industrial and post-industrial history of the region and the nation. During the industrial period, observers often call Pittsburgh, quote, the first city of capitalism. Pittsburgh not only emerged at the center of the nation's industrial development, but in the recent period, Pittsburgh has played a pioneering role in the rise of the new post-industrial order. By the mid-1980s, for example, Pittsburgh had celebrated a first and second renaissance and prepared to enter a third. In 1985 and again in 2007, Rand McNally selected Pittsburgh as the nation's most livable city, reflecting the emergence of new high technology and professional service enterprises in this region. But for our purposes, Pittsburgh, and this is perhaps most important, Pittsburgh is also home to an historic African-American community that goes back to the antebellum period. By the first half of the 20th century, a vibrant African-American community had emerged in Pittsburgh's Hill District. This vibrant community was comprised of institutions like the Pittsburgh Courier, professional Negro League baseball teams, and just a tremendous set of jazz clubs and jazz musicians. And so that, in some ways, understandably, in a recent book on Pittsburgh, sort of comparing Pittsburgh to Roanoke, Virginia, in terms of urban renewal, an author has said, and I quote, pound for pound, using a boxing metaphor, Pittsburgh, oh, this fighting thing can get out of hand, right? But Pittsburgh, she said, pound for pound, particularly the Hill District, was the most creative black community in the United States by the end of World War II. Now, we may have to do some work to try to dispute or support all of that, but if you know Pittsburgh, you know that this statement is grounded in a sense of this tremendous community among African-Americans that sprang up in this area. So for a variety of reasons, it is important to study Black Pittsburgh from the end of World War II through recent times. What I want to do in the remainder of this talk is to take a look at a few themes in the post-World War II history of African Americans in Pittsburgh. I want to begin with the Second Great Migration, because I think that this story of Black population movement is critical to understanding a variety of other aspects of the Black experience. But first, let's talk about the city that these African Americans inhabited. Pittsburgh entered a long period of economic and population decline during the years after World War II. The city lost increasing numbers of jobs and people. These people and jobs traveled to the suburbs, to the south, to the southwest, and to overseas locations. The U.S. share of the world steel industry, dominated by the Pittsburgh district, dropped from 54% at the end of World War II to only 20% in 1970. Young people in their prime working ages of 20 to 40 left the city and region in growing numbers. Between 1950 and 1970, Pittsburgh's total population declined from nearly 700,000 to about 500,000. This represented a population loss of about 11% during the 1950s and 14% during the 1960s. But it's interesting that as Pittsburgh's overall population declined, the Second Great Migration stimulated the rapid expansion of the city's Black population. The African American community increased from 62,000 in 1940 to over 105,000 in 1970. The Black population rose from about 12% to 20% of Pittsburgh's total. In the summer of 1941, Will C. Phelan, his wife, Ina May, and their five-year-old daughter, Ruth, moved to Pittsburgh from Lynch, Kentucky. As an adult, Ruth later recalled the experience of entering the Pennsylvania Railroad station near the confluence of the Three Rivers with her stepfather and her mother. In 1948, from Pensacola, Florida, another migrant, David Blakely, moved to Pittsburgh to enjoy a greater measure of freedom. As he put it, quote, "I left Pensacola because I was tired of not being able to vote and not being treated like a citizen," end of quote. But some post-war African-American migrants found Pittsburgh less promising than the places that they left. During the 1960s, for example, Betty J. Tillman moved to Pittsburgh from Washington, D.C. She was disappointed by the small number of Blacks in professional and business occupations. Some newcomers, she said, referred to Pittsburgh as, quote, "the Mississippi of the North," end of quote. Along with newcomers, the children of the first generation of African Americans, that is, the children of the first great migration, helped to expand Pittsburgh's Black community during the 1950s and 1960s. In 1929, for example, Nate Smith, the youngest of four children, was born in the city's Hill District. His parents, Luvenia and Noble Smith, had moved to Pittsburgh from Alabama during the first Great Migration. In 1948, Smith got married at the age of 18. He and his wife, Minnie, soon started their own family of four children. Smith later told an interviewer that he enjoyed fatherhood. Quote, "being a father was a great thing. I wanted to be somebody. I couldn't be somebody without my family with me," end of quote. Now, I'm going to digress just briefly because I know there are a lot of graduate students, hopefully a lot of graduate students in the room, but I want to suggest that these stories of Nate Smith, David Blakely, Will Phelan, and Betty J. Smith raise important questions about the meaning of the Second Great Migration. And I think there are three items that stand out that I want to call attention to. One is, how have historians characterized the First Great Migration compared to the Second Great Migration? And when we look at the literature, we can see both implicitly and often explicitly that the First Great Migration is treated as a population movement of despair. I mean, I should say of hope in the First Great Migration. But the Second Great Migration is treated as a population movement of despair. And so this notion that the First Great Migration was one of promise and the Second Great Migration was one of despair is grounded in some processes that had taken place by the end of World War II and that would accelerate in the years of the 1950s and 1960s. One of them is the disappearing of steel industry jobs. And all across America, manufacturing jobs disappeared. The other dimension of this ideal that the Second Great Migration was a migration of destitution, so to speak, was that the mechanization of farming and the ways in which African Americans were literally pushed off the land in the South by the end of World War II meant that they were now literally urged to go. And so I think we need to really think about how these processes played out in reality, on the ground, in various places throughout the urban areas, particularly of the North. Now, there's a second item, and this is one of the points that I am really interested in, but unfortunately, we, even in our interview processes, are yet to really systematically trace this out. And that is, what is the real image, the transport image of black people moving from the South to the North? And even in the music that we listen to, you know that the railroad is the big image. The train is the big image of black population movement. And even in this particular example that I cited earlier, the young girl in the Pennsylvania Railroad station is still an important image even in the years after World War II. And you know the idea of the Chicken Bone Express, that people talk about that, and especially the Illinois Central moving up from Mississippi into Chicago and black people having very few opportunities to get food, sort of fill up those brown bags with chicken, and by the time the train reached the destination, it looks like, you know, there are a lot of bones, okay? But now, what I would like to suggest is that we haven't paid attention to some other phenomena, and that is the Trailways Bus Company, the Greyhound Bus Company. These companies expanded in the years after World War II and no doubt played an important role in bringing a lot of African Americans out of the South into the North. And so I think we've got to try to expand that image of the ways in which black people are moving into these cities and what the mode of transport means to them. But there is also the reality that this is a period in which the private automobile becomes more important, not only for the nation, but for African Americans. And as the government constructs these superhighways, African Americans are availing themselves of these modes of transport as well. And by 1945, we start to get the formation of the U-Haul Company. And I know the U-Haul Company eventually served as a major transport of African Americans out of the South into the North. And why do I know? Because my family was, you know, we sort of travel with the U-Haul, you know. But we haven't asked ourselves as historians how many people in the 1950s and 60s really availed. So the image of the migration, while still the train is important, I think it must make way for the bus and also for these other changes. And then finally, the third item, Nate Smith, notice I said the children of the First Great Migration become important and fueling black population movement, black population growth in Pittsburgh. Well, in the established literature, we talk a lot about the conflict between the newcomers and the old residents. And we've got to think about ways that that conflict played out in the period after World War II. Because now this example of Nate Smith is an interesting one because it raises questions about whether the children of the migrants are absorbed into the lifestyles and culture of the old Pittsburghers, whereas their parents couldn't quite make it fully into that culture. Or we have to raise the question, or do these children, even if they are absorbed, do they adopt these notions of distance from these new sort of people coming into the city after World War II? And I can say that Nate Smith may be an extraordinary example because in his case, Pittsburgh-born, he later became a prize fighter, but he also became one of the most fierce civil rights activists in the city of Pittsburgh. And he fought tirelessly for poor and working class blacks. And people who were Southern-born and Pittsburgh-born perceived this man as somebody who worked in their own best interests. But whether migrant or Pittsburgh-born, African-Americans occupied the stellar of Pittsburgh's economy during the declining years of the 1950s and 1960s. Black steelworkers dominated the low-wage jobs in the coke ovens and furnaces. African-Americans complained that the steel industry refused to employ blacks, quote, in any capacity where they cannot overwork them and underplay them, end of quote. Blacks often referred to their jobs as, quote, hard work, just hard work, end of quote. They also called their work, quote, man-killing jobs, end of quote. The economic difficulties that blacks faced in the post-war years were duplicated in virtually every aspect of their lives, in housing, social services, and justice before the law. As late as 1966, the Mayor's Commission on Human Relations concluded, and I quote, that more Negroes are worse off educationally, economically, and socially than they were 12 years ago at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, end of quote. In 1967, the Pittsburgh Courier declared that Renaissance I had passed over the city's poor black community. Quote, hidden in the shadows of the city's renaissance are the slums and ghettos of Negroes. Negroes have not benefited from the resurgence fostered by the city fathers. They have been ignored and overlooked in the planning of their neighborhoods, their communities, their health, and their welfare. End of quote. A year later, the Courier not only captured the pain of urban renewal, but highlighted disproportionate unemployment and low-wage labor among black residents. Quote, homes were destroyed to make room for new buildings and streets, and poor children could witness material progress being made from their windows. They saw white men working on the projects while their fathers stood on street corners and their mothers went to work in Miss Ann's kitchen. Black people are undergoing urban renewal for the benefit of whitey, and they don't like it. Their reactions are sporadic and violent, end of quote. It was such unequal socioeconomic condition that helped to fuel the rise of the modern civil rights and black power movements in Pittsburgh and elsewhere in urban America. During the 1960s, African Americans in Pittsburgh formed a variety of new grassroots, nonviolent direct action organizations to fight for social justice. These organizations included the United Negro Protest Committee, the Black United Movement for Progress, Operation Dig, by the way, Nate Smith headed that operation, and the Black Construction Coalition. Again, Nate Smith was a major player in these organizations. Under the leadership of Bird Brown, an attorney and president of the NAACP, these groups came together in a coalition and targeted discrimination in a broad range of institutions in the region: department stores, hospitals, schools, construction trades, the steel industry, utility companies, real estate firms, banks, and other financial institutions. Almost all of these organizations witnessed protests, pickets, and marches against their establishment in order to break down racial barriers in the job market. By the late 1960s, despite the escalation of marches, protests, and legal actions, the color line persisted, and it was at this time that the Black Power phase of the African American freedom struggle came to Pittsburgh. Gail Austin, a student activist at the University of Pittsburgh, later described the modern civil rights and Black Power movement as, quote, "the same movement, but two wings," end of quote. Along with many other Black Pittsburghers, Austin heard Stokely Carmichael of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee speak at both the University of Pittsburgh and then in the Hill District. This is very important. By this time, speakers on major campuses who were involved in the movement, they almost never accepted an invitation unless you created a venue for them to speak in the community. And this was over and over again, so that in a way, universities were underwriting a community-based grassroots social movement, whether they liked it or not. Austin later recalled that Carmichael's eloquence, logic, and determination attracted her to the ideology of Black Power. Between 1964 and 1967, violence had already erupted in cities across the urban North and West. In Pittsburgh, African Americans warned city officials to act in a, quote, "a spirit of commitment. If not, there's going to be bloodshed," end of quote. As early as March 1968, the Pittsburgh Courier reported plans for a B-Day, that is, a burn day. And this B-Day was planned for May of 1968. But on April 5th, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King's assassination, violence erupted in Pittsburgh a month earlier than predicted. Beginning at a meat market on Center Avenue in the Hill District, over the next 8 days, looting and firebombing spread to other parts of the city and region. An African-American policeman later recalled that, quote, "youngsters were very angry. You could feel the hatred and hostility," end of quote. As the violence spread into Homewood Brushton on the east side, the governor dispatched some 4,000 National Guardsmen to supplement the city's 1,400-man police force. Reverend Leroy Patrick later described the warlike atmosphere that surrounded his neighborhood church. He said, and I quote, "I went out to look at the troops standing on Homewood Avenue. I could hardly believe this in Pittsburgh. Troops with combat gear, big boots, khaki, helicopters overhead, that kind of thing is indelibly impressed on your mind," end of quote. Alma Fox, an executive director of the local NAACP, remembered a similar scene at about the same time. The police tactical squad lined up with their legs spread and touching shoe to shoe. They held their nightsticks in front, and they looked 10 miles long. You have to picture this scene with flames up Center Avenue and the line of police facing us, end of quote. 5 nights of arson and looting resulted in 13 arrests one death, 515 fires, and $620,000 in property damage. Following the 1968 riot, white business and social welfare, as well as political leaders, expressed greater sensitivity, at least at the rhetorical level and to some extent at the material level, to the needs of the black community. Tim Stevens, youth director of the NAACP at the time, recalled that it was frustrating to those of us who didn't believe in violence, but the riots of 1968 did bring things to focus. Area companies developed aggressive campaigns to promote their image as, quote, equal opportunity employers. They sent letters to civil rights and social service organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League. They confirmed their commitment to non-discriminatory hiring policies. They also regularly paid for advertisements in the black press. Ads featured photos of black employees and assured black readers that Pittsburgh companies stood for, quote, equality and also quality people for a quality product, end of quote. But corporate, small business, and even labor responses, I haven't talked much about labor responses, but collectively, these responses to the needs of Pittsburgh's growing black population were slow and fundamentally inadequate. Pittsburgh found it increasingly difficult to create new jobs, hold on to its existing population, and attract new people into the region. And so this is a period between 1970, the early 70s, and the onset of the 21st century. The city's population as a whole started to drop even more. It dropped to about 370,000 people by the 1990s. The transformation of the city's economy, the loss of the steel industry and infrastructure sort of deterioration took a huge toll on Pittsburgh's African-American community. And it was for the first time, by the way, that Pittsburgh's black population declined. During the antebellum period, the African-American population had dropped during that repressive period against those people who were involved in the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement. Black people left Pittsburgh in the wake of all of those repressive moments, and their population after the Civil War continued to grow, and it was only during this period that their population declined again, dropping from over 105,000 in 1970 to just about 92,000 in the 1990s. One journalist pointed out that growing numbers of blacks left the region and that almost everybody in Pittsburgh knew of somebody else, that is, among blacks, and also among whites for that matter, who had left the region and did not return. According to Ralph Proctor, who served as director of the Kingsley Association, that's a youth center in East Liberty, young blacks, he said, left the region because of declining opportunities, but he also accented that racism was also a factor. Eric Webb, an award-winning poet and journalist, told a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter that Pittsburgh was a good place for white families to raise their children, but for African-American families, he said, those opportunities were not there. In the spring of 1990, the Wall Street Journal carried a front-page story on the reverse migration of middle-class African-Americans from northern cities like Pittsburgh to Sunbelt cities like Atlanta. Attorney Justin L. Johnson, the son of a prominent Pennsylvania Superior Court judge, returned to Pittsburgh after receiving his law degree from Harvard in 1986. But by 1980, Johnson had moved to Atlanta, Georgia. In Pittsburgh, Johnson told the Wall Street Journal, quote, I had every advantage, but I really feel more comfortable here. In Pittsburgh, I was always in a white environment, and I had the feeling of isolation. Down here, you are successful, and you see successful blacks, and you feel a sense of well-being and pride, end of quote. At about the same time, Eric Thompson, a 29-year-old accountant, quit his job at Mellon Bank's Pittsburgh office. He also moved to Atlanta. He took a job at Coca-Cola's corporate headquarters. According to Thompson, in Atlanta, you see more blacks in positions where they have an effect on what he called the bottom line. During the final decades of the 20th century, African Americans in Pittsburgh not only confronted the persistence of the color line and conflicts between blacks and whites, they also faced the emergence of more intense social division within the black community. Now, time will not permit me to talk about all of this, but I do want to outline that some of the internal conflicts, some of the major internal conflicts, revolved around these areas. One, urban renewal. Two, public housing. Three, public schools. Four, return migration to the Hill District, gentrification. Five, emergence of youth violence and drug wars. And six, suburbanization. All of these had within them elements of intra-racial conflict of various kinds, particularly class. But urban renewal, I have to comment on. When the Hill District, Lower Hill District, was destroyed in the 1950s, African Americans from that community, and by the way, this process disrupted what you see down here in Pittsburgh in this downtown area used to be partly a very vibrant African-American community. Previously, a community, Solomon Dean talked about that community. It was a very mixed, multi-ethnic community, but gradually by the 1950s and 60s, it became predominantly African-American. Well, the destruction of that community not only sort of set up a scenario whereby African-Americans had a beef with the city and with white power, but it also set up a scenario that caused a tremendous internal conflict. For example, large numbers of African Americans who relocated from the Hill went into areas called East Liberty and Homewood-Brushton area. There had always been a small number of African Americans in those communities, but they were disproportionately homeowners. And this tremendous displacement of blacks from the Hill meant that there was a tremendous migration into these areas, and these black homeowners were just as fearful of losing value in their homes as anybody else, and they were very cautious, in some ways resistant to the idea of just simply opening up that area. And true enough, those areas became predominantly African-American over time. But this is also closely related to other things, like public housing. Solomon Dean talked about that, and I think nobody can put it any better than he put it. And that is, public housing in Pittsburgh became a way of internal stratification among blacks themselves, a kind of intra-racial class division that would find people from public housing suffering this kind of, you know, image of people who were somehow, you know, on the downside of respectability and so on. And so those things would be real within the context of the black community. Now, looking out, they may not have looked as prominent, but inside, you know, slight differences sometimes can cause tremendous tension. So we can't talk about, and by the way, schools became, as Solid suggested, battlegrounds in a wave of tension. But the ideas by the late 20th century, African Americans are finding alternative ways to educate their children. And so you're seeing the beginnings of these private academies springing up, also private enrollment of black students in predominantly white private schools become much more. So there are those things. But I just want to say in conclusion that while some of these conflicts were extraordinarily destructive and threatened to rend the fabric of the African-American community, black Pittsburghers did not despair. They responded to these new and more complex social currents with energy, creativity, and hope. As white opposition to affirmative action, for example, another story to be told, intensified, in some ways blacks rekindle some of the aspects of the most intense moments of the nonviolent direct action in black power movement over the 80s. I mean, the civil rights movement in terms of those strategies didn't totally disappear. As the old industrial order declined and the city of Pittsburgh created a predominantly white renaissance, African Americans sought to forge their own more hopeful black renaissance. And actually you begin to see the name on black organizations that start to carry these renaissance names. And so we need to probe that more for the degree to which it says to the city that black people are participating unequally in this process, and therefore they have to create something in the context of this larger renaissance that is more just, and so on. While the full outcome of this new community that is evolving in Pittsburgh is yet to be seen or determined, it is clear that African Americans in Pittsburgh will play an influential role in helping to build a more just and humane social order in this century than the one they recently left behind. Thank you.